Coming from the fringes of Silicon Valley, talking about technology every week, this is Geeksby. Today's episode,
Augment Your Goat Pictures at IKEA,
starts now.
Geeks often spend time discussing the pitfalls of technology. Today, they look at some of the upsides, from microscopes that help find cancer to simpler directions from your mapping app, and even IKEA furniture building robots. GeekSpeak is your source for trends in tech.
I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room in Los Gatos is Miles Elam. Hey, Miles.
Good evening.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. Tell me about augmented reality and Google.
We talk about the poor choices that are made with tech companies a lot, the dangers of technology, but I don't think we spend enough time talking about the good that comes from technology. And this is one of those stories. Google and augmented reality, they have a microscope that when looking at cells, human cells, cell cultures, it is able to quickly highlight cancer cells using
Image recognition.
Yes.
What do you mean highlight?
Basically, you have augmented reality doing a circle or some type of
overlay.
Some sort of identification. And then you have AI going through the whole panel looking for specific patterns that fit what we consider cancer.
So an AI helping do the enhance, but not the enhance, more like a focus.
Yes.
So this is a microscope that a human's using. Of course, it's actually a video screen with a microscope because that's how new microscopes work. And then an artificial layer being added, augmented by the AI.
Right. And it's not technology replacing the doctor. It's having the doctor look and have something just punch out.
Assist the doctor.
Right. Because we all know.
So she can spot it quickly.
We all know from many stories that you'll have residents at hospitals and stuff like that who are very much overworked because you have a lot to learn in a very short amount of time.
So why is this coming out of Google? What arm of Google? I guess it's Alphabet. What arm of Alphabet's doing bio imaging?
The section is actually just referred to as Google Research.
Oh, okay. I got in a whole conversation recently about this because it is easy to get in the mire of how bad technology is because of the side effects we see. And, you know, when I did the talk for the League of Women Voters in Santa Cruz when you and I were down there, we talked a bit about, there's great things happening too, even though there's some real challenges for us in a technology society, where especially with most of the populace doesn't understand what's actually happening in the details. There's all these wonderful things like less people die of starvation now, percentage-wise, than ever on the planet. You know, people have a longer lifetime than ever in the planet. Like, there's all these great things that we're doing as well.
In addition to resources like fact-checkers, which there were journalists. You know, the journalism profession was a bit different in the past, but there's still a lot of resources out there to say, hey, here's a little bit of help for you. You're not just out there in the wilderness. If you really want to find out what's really true and what's not, you can.
And not to mention just learning anything you want to learn. Like, I've picked up blacksmithing lately, and when I want to do a certain thing in blacksmithing, I go find the 15 YouTube videos about how to do that. And the increase in education that you get from that is staggering.
So have you ever temporarily blinded yourself from blacksmithing?
You know, I did rip my cornea a little bit a couple weeks ago. But, you know, it's funny. You wear goggles. Every time you're doing any kind of metal work, you got to wear goggles because a little flake of metal, even though it can hurt your skin, it could blind you and definitely cause a lot of pain. So you're, like, wearing eye protection the entire time. So a couple weeks ago, I'm spending the entire time at Roaring Camp, which is an amazing place we have in Felton that has old steam engines, and it's kind of like an adventure park kind of space. Anyway, I'm the sometimes fill in for Frank Golding, who's the actual blacksmith on site, and I fill in for him when he's out of town. So last weekend he was out of town, and I'm there banging away at the anvil all day with my goggles on. I go home that evening, and Maggie goes, "Clean up, you're a mess." And I've got like soot and stuff all over my face. So I take my goggles off and wash my face. And when I do that, I inject the stuff on my skin into my eyeball. And then I go, "Ow," and push my eye, ripping my little tear. So it was completely after I was – but I say the next day, you know, I hurt my eye blacksmithing and everyone's like, "Oh my God, are you okay?" "Yeah, I'm fine." It's all healed up now. Thanks, docs. Is that it on augmented reality?
That is.
All right. And how awesome technology is? Speaking of cool technology, blacksmithing, I got to say an anvil and a hammer and a fire. Love it.
For a minute, I thought you were going to say a hammer and a sickle.
A long time ago, a friend of mine was working at a little startup in San Jose somewhere area. And he invited me over for the day because I was a developer. I was working at UCSC at the time. And he invited me over to kind of see what it was like there. And I was a programmer. And I kind of did a day hanging out at this company. This company took photos and just made a good online repository of photos, kind of like Flickr did at the day. And they were really neat people, owned by a family. Father of the family was running the company. And it's one of his sons worked there. And a lot of neat developers. And my friend worked there. And the atmosphere was really cool. And I spent the day and kind of gave some feedback on some of the stuff. I decided not to leave UCSC. They didn't actually make me an official offer, but there seemed to be an opening there if I wanted to, but I didn't move on. But right after that, I signed up for SmugMug and became a subscriber to SmugMug and have been paying ever since as like a pro account. But I pay a pretty big amount of money every year to allow myself to store as much photos as I possibly want on the service. And I take photographs of like events for people and then I'll make a folder there. And it's been nice to have a standard location. And all my photos are up at my own domain so that if I ever want to move away from SmugMug, I can just scrape the whole thing down and then rehost it on my own domain. So there's a lot of features that I like as a developer. So SmugMug recently just announced they're buying Flickr. They're purchasing Flickr from, I guess it was Yahoo or Verizon. I can't remember what company actually owns it at this point, but it was bought by Yahoo in 2009 or so, maybe earlier than that. And at that time, if you had a pro account, it got transferred and became kind of a pain for me. So I kind of stopped using Flickr around that time. But I've always used SmugMug. I don't know, it seems strange that SmugMug's actually consuming Flickr because you would assume it would have gone the other way around. Supposedly, they're going to keep the Flickr service up running the way it runs as a free photo sharing site, and the pro services being more on the SmugMug side. Any case, if you want to see pictures of Miles and me all over KOSP, the old radio station we used to be at every week, you can go take a look at today's show and take a look at the KOSP Studios photo collection of me and Miles hanging out around with a lot of other people at the studios. And I got to say, Miles, if you look through those photos, it's a little sad because it's all gone. And if me talking about SmugMug has made you want to sign up for SmugMug, please feel free to use my referral code so I get a free month, because that'd be cool. All right. Done with shameless plug of me as a photographer. Let's talk about bot-powered learning labs.
GitHub has become the go-to place for a lot of developers, not just independent and open source, but for companies as well. My company uses GitHub as well, private repositories. One of the things about GitHub, though, is got to be the question of where do you go from here? Once you become this ubiquitous resource for developers in general to outsource all of their integration needs, their continuous integration development, stuff like that, and that comes to be, in my mind, you add more developers. You get more a larger percentage of the population involved. Mm-hmm. And that appears to be where they're headed, as they are making a bot-powered learning lab. In other words, something that tries to combine the internet in terms of just availability of information with a bot, something that can try to interact with you more on a one-on-one basis to track where your progress is, where you may need help. Try to bridge that gap from the in-person teaching, you know, classroom experience, which I think is highly underrated, by the way. I know so many people that are struggling to learn, and I think back to my experience when I was first learning how to program and having that first step where someone is teaching you how to get started, how to make those first few changes, make that first compile, make that loop.
The mentoring.
Yeah, just made a huge difference that allows you to go further and examine, you know, new areas that you want to go, and just that foundation of knowledge, in much the same way as someone teaching you your ABCs and your basic sight words as a way for you to learn more about the language, because then you can jump further and learn how to, you know, learn new words and teach yourself. And at the same time, it's hard to find good teachers, and good teachers are expensive.
Yeah.
Even when you underpay them, hopefully, which is the case by and large for education. And so having a tool that tries to address that, tries to help people out, try to get more information
to makes
them
sense.
As a bot.
Yeah. How does a bot do that? Like, what is it that, why do you claim that it's a bot? And how does a bot help guide?
Well, this is not about programming in general, although I was alluding to that earlier. Mm-hmm. This is obviously something made for GitHub, which is how to use the GitHub platform. And in some ways, how to use Git. Because it will say, okay, what do you need to do next? Leading you toward the goals of how to be a better software engineer. Okay, create an issue. Here are the things that I need to do, like your to-do list. You put down what your goals are. Now, assign yourself. That makes it
It's
yours.
Using the workflow that we all use as developers.
Right, but we've learned it over years from using it. So this is something that, you know, that would be the equivalent of a coworker coming in and saying, oh, yeah, now you're going to do this, and you're going to do this, then you're going to do step three.
This has a lot of familiarity to me with a show we did in January of 2013, where we had Adam Fortana on from Code School. Code School is an online learning repository. And one of the things they've done is create these courses that are thematic and guidance-based around these things. One of their free examples is Try Git. And what you do in Try Git, that course from Code School, is you actually create an account on GitHub and create a repository and, you know, check things out and edit things. It's very similar to the thing you're describing.
It's that difference between following a checklist from another site or a video, like, and having it integrated with the UI itself.
Well, so I did the Try Git, and it is using the UI itself.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Oh, yeah. You're kind of like oddly integrated with it. It was a very neat experience. It reminds me of what you're describing now as the bot process. Now, of course, I can imagine GitHub, the company, trying to do that themselves as well. It makes a lot of sense, especially as this course is, you know, from years and years ago.
We do get messages from time to time, people saying, how do I get started? How do I get going? Yeah. And it's really hard to answer that question because different people have different modalities for how it clicks for them in their mind. For some people, the traditional computer science education works wonders for them. They get in, they're like, I love this. There are other folks that they need something that's more goal-oriented, more practical. And so getting them into web development, for example, to start off with as that introduction works better for them than doing math analysis, which is what computer science ends up being, being applied mathematics. And then there are other folks where they just need someone to talk them through a step. And once they do it a couple of times, then they take it on. And that's where I think this bot comes into that play.
Yeah, cool. Are you going to try it out? I mean, I know you know Git very well, so it might not be useful to you.
I have to admit I won't, but that's mostly because I'm already knee-deep in GitHub as it is.
Okay, so what we're going to do is, if you haven't experienced Git and you're kind of curious what we're talking about when we're talking about source control and what we do, go ahead and try this course, this bot, I guess, from GitHub. Is it available now?
Yes, the GitHub Learning Lab.
Okay, you linked to the VentureBeat article about it. But I've also linked to our episode from 2013 with Adam on it from Code School and the Git tutorial online from Code School. So you can try one of those, maybe try both of those, and let us know what you think. Anytime you want to give us feedback and stuff, of course, you can hit us up on social medias. We'll be responsive to that to some degree. You can also email us. I love the idea of social medias because then the conversation's all public and it's easy for us to – for multiple people to participate.
Right. And I don't think it's so much about learning Git, although it will be teaching you how to interact with Git. But it's more of – what I think of as the workflow for software engineering.
Yes, that's a good point.
It's a bit more nebulous. It's a bit harder to describe for people who haven't been inducted into it. Like, you can list it out, but it really isn't until you start doing it.
And let's talk just a couple of those fundamentals. If you and I are in the same company, we're working together, you're working on something, I'm working on something, even if we're tangentially involved with each other's code, at some point you're going to be done with a piece that you can kind of save into our code base. And I'm going to want access to that as well. So you'll submit what we call a pull request. And what this basically does is allows me to comment on it and give feedback. So I can look over what you're doing, kind of be aware of what you're doing, maybe make a suggestion, hey, you got to check for this null situation here. So that whole process allows us to communicate about what we're doing with regard to code.
Right. But there's also one step before that, which is you specify the issue or you put into projects your game plan. And so you say, here's your overall game plan. Let's turn each of those steps into an issue. Your issue becomes your to-do list. You go to the issue, you see which ones are available, which ones are assigned to you.
Let's harden this idea. So let's say there's a spelling error on geekspeak.org, which happens a lot because I develop on it. And you might notice the spelling problem and might, instead of fixing it or telling me about it directly, you'll just create an issue on GitHub saying, Lyle misspelled this word, fix it. I see on my list of to-dos an item that's called – the issue is called fixed spelling problem. I look at it and it's even noted on the certain line of code. When I go touch that file to make the change, I denote that it's about that issue that you developed, closing my issue, opening a pull request that you can then say, yep, you spelled it right correctly, click a button, and it gets merged.
Then you have stuff in GitHub that's when you're putting the pull request in there to say fixes number 375. And when you submit that pull request for me to look at, and I say, yep, that's spelled correctly now, and I approve it, when you commit it, it automatically closes
that
the pull request.
That issue,
It closes the issue, and it merges that code into the main code base.
And one of the things that's amazing about this is that open source projects do this all the time. So even if you're not a developer on it, if you look at a bit of code and you're not sure why it's done that way, you can look at the history of all the changes that took place and also the conversations about those changes. It's a really amazing way of talking about what's going on, kind of like the conversation sides of the Wikipedia articles that you might, you know, be curious about why it was written that way. There's history behind it. Anyway, really great way to learn how to code, really great way to understand what's happening. And if you're developing and learn that the initial process, you're halfway there. So GitHub launches bot-powered learning lab for budding developers. Thank you, Miles. Let's talk about face recognition, but not for people.
Right, because the face recognition for people that a lot of tech companies are pushing is kind of creepy. But we're not talking about creepy on this episode. We're talking about cool. We're talking about unambiguously
awesome.
Good. Yeah.
And optimistic.
Which is face recognition for galaxies.
Okay. Why do you need this?
Because when you have pictures being taken by Hubble and soon the James Webb telescope, you have all of this raw information, so many galaxies, that even when you had the deep field view, for example, where they took a patch of sky that seemed to be devoid of any stars or anything, and it turned out it was chock full of stars and galaxies, or chock full of galaxies, which are comprised of stars. And at the same time, if even the smallest patch of sky that appears dark is filled to the brim with galaxies from our perspective, imagine the rest of the sky, and it becomes a huge task in categorizing these galaxies because you want to be
able – types of galaxies?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking when you were describing facial recognition, I was thinking, well, that every image is unique, therefore every galaxy is unique, and so it's – but you always know where the galaxy is. You know exact points, and therefore you don't need that. So you're saying classifications of galaxies,
right,
trying to find similarities and things of that nature.
Exactly, because if you find some similarities, you can find where most of them are generally the same but one oddball in there, and that's where the really interesting stuff comes
in.
You
find out what's going on. Yeah.
Or where you see a whole bunch of commonalities without exception. You go, huh, why are they all so uniform? But this is a huge task, and we have a lot of human volunteers out there categorizing and doing their best. But AI, computers in general, when you get them to the point where they can do a task that only humans have done in the past, you find that they not only do it with a certain level of accuracy, but they do it much faster than human beings do. And so you have this you have AI being applied to pure science to the advancement of overall human knowledge as it relates to our place in the cosmos. And
very
what's
poetic,
even
sir.
Better is that this is being done out of our alma mater, UC Santa Cruz.
Nice. Very cool. Our last episode together, we talked a lot about Facebook, and we talked a lot about the creepiness of Facebook and such. And one of the things we didn't talk about is how to help mitigate and still use Facebook. So I thought a good opportunity to say there are tools out here that allow you to use Facebook and also not have the kind of problems that we've seen that people don't like. So one of those things is to go into your Facebook account, look at what permissions you've given to things, and remove everything you don't need to have permission on. If you have some game you've accessed or something like that, you couldn't really be aware of what you've given permissions on. And you can do that pretty relatively easy by diving through the settings on a logged in a Facebook account. And you can help other people as well. Okay, so that's one thing, just to kind of understand what third parties you've given access to. Now,
assuming, of course, you don't want to just stop using your Facebook account.
Which is completely valid, but I think some people are going to say that's not something they want to do. The second thing is to use a browser with multiple profiles. And this is something I highly recommend. I do this all the time for work. So I'm using Chrome. And in Chrome, you can actually create multiple what they call people. And you actually, when you do this, when you create extra people, if you will, you have a menu item people and all the accounts you've made. And so I have my Lyle at Netflix account, and I have my Lyle at personal account, and I have my Lyle at GeekSpeak account. And basically, with all three of those, I'm logged into my Gmail in those different experiences. It's kind of like different instances of Chrome. Mm-hmm. But the benefit of this is that when I log in to Facebook on one of those, when I browse the web in a different profile, there's no communication about what Facebook account I have. I never log into Facebook with my work account, for example. But additionally, you can make a whole profile, a whole person profile called Facebook. And the only time you ever log into Facebook is using that profile. Now, it's a little annoying because when you want to do things like from Facebook, click on a news article or whatever, you actually have to copy the link and figure out what it is, or just open another browser that's not the Facebook thing and do a Google search for the same term, finding it and then getting to it. So there's ways of mitigating the expansiveness of Facebook. And the reason I brought this up is that we had a great article linked to us by Christopher Said, asked us to take a look and give some thoughts on this article called No Boundaries for Facebook Data, Third-Party Trackers Abuse Facebook Login. And this is just an analysis on how, even without Facebook doing anything to share data, using Facebook and using the scripts that are available on sites can potentially grant access to third parties you're not aware of. So you visit GeekSpeak's site, and on there, there's a login through Facebook. And so if you did – I don't actually have that on GeekSpeak, but if you did that, what that means is that I get some identification, like the site that you're on, the GeekSpeak site, get some identification of your email address and your name and stuff, because effectively you've said it's okay to share that with my site, which is fine for this one site of GeekSpeak, but lots of times there are third-party scripts running on people's sites. Mm-hmm. Things like – and it's hard
to describe. People getting ad revenue, yep. Or getting analytics data.
And sometimes it's just really useful tools. Like maybe they'll want to use something like the JavaScript engine jQuery, which allows you to do some beneficial things, simplifying some JavaScript code on mm-hmm. your site. And you might embed that from someplace. Or it's a WordPress site, and the WordPress site allows you to auto-format the page a certain way. All of these things that the developer has decided to do actually grant those third-party systems access to the same information that they have. And so it's very easy to accidentally be the website that is sharing your data accidentally to other people. The advertising thing, of course, is a no-brainer in the sense that the site wants to make money off of your visit. You kind of want them to make money because you like reading their site. That's why you're there. You might put up an ad blocker, which would kind of stop these things. So in general, I'm not real pessimistic on this side. I understand how this works. I'm not really concerned about it. But the truth is that my understanding of how it works empowers me to assess what's okay and what's not okay. And I do that without thinking about it, right? Like a safe driver on the road is safer mm-hmm. than a non-safe driver.
But it's this curious combination of the person who's making a website that has these integration, Facebook integrations or other sites. It's not just Facebook mm-hmm. that this is an issue. They need to have a combination of technical savvy and a very well-defined sense of ethics.
Right.
If you lack the technical savvy, you may not be ethically compromised. You just don't recognize the security ramifications of it.
It's really tricky because, like on my personal site, my lyle.troxel.com site, all that's there is a script that goes and grabs my most recent posts off of Tumblr and republishes them. This allows me to use the easy interface of Tumblr and other online services. So I post an Instagram post and it auto-posts to Tumblr, and that auto-updates my personal site. So my personal site's kind of like a clearinghouse of things that I've decided to share publicly, mostly blacksmithing and my kids and my dog. But when I did that, to actually achieve that purpose, I had to run code from Tumblr to actually get that feed. And because of that, anybody that visits my site is inherently, I'm kind of forcing the trust of Tumblr onto them. That's a convenience thing, right? I could, of course, run something on the back end and do this without subjugating the people to access Tumblr. I could, write a Node script or something. But I've decided, because of what the purpose is, it's not worth the time and energy. And those little decisions actually cause a lot of confusion about what's available for people that are doing mischievous things. So separate out the sites you run. If you're really concerned about it, put up an ad blocker. I find that when you put up an ad blocker and you start engaging in that, you start getting overwhelmed with how much you have to block, and that makes the web a little less usable.
Yeah, the whole thing here is a lot of the advice that we're giving right now, I feel, is out of the scope of your typical user, both in skill level, but also with regard to time. There are some people, for most folks, you could figure this out. You could figure out how to make a profile in Chrome, but it's a time investment. And I totally understand when someone goes, I just don't have time for this. I'm just going to use the system.
Yeah, it's true.
As it is. And I don't have an easy answer for that.
But don't you think a Chrome profile is a good middle ground?
It is. And we've used Chrome profiles before, and so we know what's involved and how to use it.
But the truth is, I know that I've like we have a shared laptop at home that we share around, and you know, so one of my family members will use it for half a day without realizing that they're logged in by to somebody else, right? Because it's easy not to look at that name up in the upper right-hand corner. So I do see that it's more about our own awareness of it. So more legislation? I think that a general audience that sticks with this show understands that there's implications on everything they're doing on technology. That's why they're kind of listening to what we have to say about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if you're going to do one thing to kind of protect your identity online, get a password manager. And the next thing would be to understand what your public face looks like while you're online. So if you've taken a browser and you've logged into Facebook, everywhere you go now, people know who you are. If you have two profiles, one profile is logged into Facebook and one profile is not logged in, it makes it a lot harder for people to assess who you are.
Yeah, this is where
you're like, eh, doesn't
after
matter.
After the last few weeks, time has been rendered much more precious in my mind.
Why is that, sir?
I've had a series of trials and tribulations with a project that I'm working on.
Wait, is that project a work project or a goat project?
A little bit of column A, a lot of column A and a little bit of column B.
Big work project, launch, some difficulty, some technology challenges. You've been really busy on that.
Yeah, replacing an airplane engine while it's flying.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Have you succeeded? Is it running still?
Yes, it is.
Did anyone die?
No.
That's good.
Happily, this was not a life or death situation.
Speaking of life or death, though, and since I touched upon it, what is going on with your home at that?
We have five new baby goats.
Kids. Were they birthed at your home?
Yes.
That's pretty awesome. So your daughter's like completely in love with them?
You have no idea how hard it is to get a six-year-old to stop picking up the babies and carrying them around everywhere. It's like, no, you just don't. Just leave them alone. Let them come to you.
But isn't that also kind of good because then they'll be acclimated to people?
There's a difference between being acclimated and being
annoyed.
Subjected to a young child who doesn't fully understand boundaries yet with animals.
Okay.
Because when you have young children, there are precious few, I believe, young children who innately understand boundaries with animals for whatever reason. They're just unnaturally sweet children. My daughter.
I've never met one, Miles.
Yes. My daughter is unnaturally sweet in many ways, but with regard to her care of animals, she's not one of those. Mm. And I remember being that age, and your desire to be with an animal or have an animal be close to you in a certain way or be at an angle a certain way is not coalesced in your mind with what is the desire of this animal at this point. And so there's, no, I don't want this animal to go away. And you grab the leg and you're just like, do not haul this animal by its leg. You know, it's a baby. You don't.
But other than that, sweet animals?
Yes. And my daughter is also learning. So it's a learning process all around. She started with adult goats, and adult goats are far more sturdy.
Yeah.
So that also.
And you can't pick them up. Or a child can't pick them up.
She can't, yeah. But yes, they are ridiculously cute.
Do you know the sexes yet of these animals? Are you going to keep all of them or are they?
No, we're not keeping them.
Are there food animals or are they milking animals? What's the plan?
It's complicated.
We should title this episode Blacksmithing and Goats.
Yes. One of the reasons for having the goats, as we diverge from tech, is for milking so that the moms will go back into milk. We have two does. And at the same time, we were looking at breeding the goats to have certain qualities that were desirable. And we probably will be selling the kids.
Keeping the ones that are desirable and selling the kids?
No, selling all overall. But yeah.
Oh, okay.
Are
you making cheese or something with all this milk? Or right now you don't have any milk?
My wife has made goat cheese already.
Miles, I want to ask you a sensitive question. I don't want to put a spear in your relationship or anything. Do you like goat milk and goat cheese?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. Because some people can't stand it. I don't mind it at all, but my wife doesn't like the taste of it. So no goats for us. That's good that you like it.
Yeah. It was curious, though, because you think of male, female, you get about 50-50. Yeah, no, we got 80% males.
Of course, because you didn't want them. So now, can you sell the males?
Yeah.
Are they going to be eaten by somebody?
Are
you going to tell your daughter before you do that?
I don't know. There is one that is very cute and possibly polled, which is naturally hornless and blue-eyed. So that one may fetch a pretty price.
Why?
A goat that you don't have to – normally with horns. Normally with goats, and sorry for folks with some sensitive ears.
Miles is going to describe something really horrible they do to animals. Go ahead.
Yes. Baby goats, by and large, so that they don't have horns, you have what is effectively a branding iron. You hold it to their heads to kill the buds where the horns grow from.
So that the animal never has horns.
Yes.
So that no one gets skewered.
Well,
or is it that they fight each other?
The horns actually in general will grow backward.
Mm-hmm.
But
like goat horns.
Yes, there there are facing backwards.
I know what a goat looks like, sir. But
no, not all goats have the same type of horns, but these in particular will go backwards. There are different thoughts behind it. One, obviously, when they have horns and they hit you, it hurts more.
Mm-hmm.
There's the issue of they can get caught on a fence. To put their head through, it's harder to get their head out in certain scenarios. And some people just don't like the aesthetics of having the horn.
Right, because if they have horns, they represent the devil more. Okay, so you actually have a male that probably actually won't have horns. And you said blue eyes? Like the creepy mm-hmm. goat eye is actually – the iris is blue?
Yes.
Wow. I want to see that. That's neat.
Yeah, we got a couple of blue-eyed. We're surprised we didn't get more, but but at least 40% of them are blue-eyed.
I am hearing most of our audience right now screaming, get back to tech! So let's get back to tech. Let's talk about Google Maps.
The common way for people to give directions to their friends is not turn left on Church Street, turn right on Locust, you know, the type of thing. It's look for the Burger King out the corner. Watch out for the sock shop. It's going to be two doors down from the sock shop, or, you know, Bookshop Santa Cruz, go to the left of Bookshop Santa Cruz, not to the right-hand side, you know.
Yeah, human directions.
Yes. Google Maps is starting to incorporate that. So when they give directions, it's going to start looking at landmarks and telling you those, because those are easier for many people to spot and, you know, objectively easier to spot in many cases than the street sign.
Especially when you're dealing with, like, In-N-Out Burger has this 700-foot sign that says In-N-Out Burger, and you clearly know that sign is for this exit. And the exit sign, of course, just says, like, you know, exit 57. If it says, get off where the In-N-Out sign is, it's a lot easier to see that, obviously.
Right. So the example given here was turn right after Room and Board on the right onto 7th Street. So it's combining all of those modalities. When that gets read out to you, turn-by-turn directions, like that's a lot more easy for general people to use.
You were kind of in the location service. When you worked at Google, that's what you worked on, is the locale stuff, right?
Very limited. It was more of the
– tangential.
We were called geo-consumer. In other words, we
– geo-consumer.
Yes. We took the geocoding information and incorporated it into the information that we were displaying.
Okay. I see. So cool. And we've seen that roll out already? Have they productized that, or are they testing it?
This is probably in the experimentation phase, because some people have noticed it and other people haven't. So chances are
it's being testing it.
Yeah. Chances are it's being rolled out.
And can you describe A/B testing?
A/B testing is where you're trying out a new feature or bug fix or the like, and you want to see how it's going to be received. And it may not even be on a conscious level. It's not from users saying, I like this or don't like this, although that can be incorporated. It's more along the lines of, do people end up getting to their destination faster? Do people not miss their turn as often? Because you can detect if the map has to recalculate the route, do recalculations drop?
So what they do is they take 100 million people and they try this feature out for them. So that 100 million people on Google Maps is using that for maybe 2 weeks, and they look at how effective the people getting to their destination was compared to the people that don't have this feature, and whichever one did better, everyone gets that feature.
Yep.
It's pretty cool. We use it at Netflix. Facebook uses it. All the companies use it. And I've done a talk for the last couple of years at UCSC about the same topic, because I think it's so fascinating. That's Google Maps Drives. And now you also have a story about a robot and IKEA.
Yes. IKEA. The
store we love to hate.
Yes. Well, we love the store, except that it ends up being cavernous. And you're like, wait, where's the way out? How do I Then you get the item, which is a very heavy flat box. You somehow get it in your car. You get it home, and then you have to put it together.
And you break up with your spouse.
Well, it turns out there is a robot that can build an IKEA chair faster than you can, which for many people go, yeah, anyone can build an IKEA chair faster than I can. But whereas robots...
And with less swearing, probably.
Yes. Robots are actually able to figure out, like, hey, let's take this thing. We're going to manipulate.
Is this only one chair, or is this all chairs from IKEA? Is this robot, like, really good at this one chair?
I'm inclined to think that it talks about one particular chair.
It's the Inkla chair. That's cool. I feel like I've heard this story before about a robot making furniture from IKEA.
The robots took pictures identifying each part of the chair.
Cool.
Then an algorithm planned the motions that the robot needed to do to manipulate the objects without having them collide.
And it did it.
Then it did it.
Oh, I love the idea of if it took human duration to do this, it'd be like, you know, 2 hours of looking at the stuff and meditating and then like 4 minutes of putting it together really fast, you know? Because, of course, if you do think about something and you can spatially be aware of it, it is...
What is part C? I don't see a part C1. What is part C1? What? What?
All right, that's cool. Let's talk about an impressive thing hackers have done.
This is the headline here from Business Insider. Hackers once stole a casino's high roller database through a thermometer in the lobby fish tank.
Wait, what?
Now, this goes under the headline of security is only as good as its weakest link.
Okay, so of course, the security at the hotel and casino was really good. And then they outsourced...
objectively, it wasn't very good. But.
No, and then they outsourced the aquarium maintenance to a company that put a thermometer in it that connected to the Wi-Fi. That's not good. First, why do you have to have a fish tank with a thermometer that connects to the internet?
Well, this, I think, goes under the heading of Internet of Things, and many of them are internet connected. And so you... To configure them, you have to connect them to your network.
Yeah, but also it does make sense to remotely control. I mean, I had a watering system at my last house, which I set up, and it was wirelessly managed, and it was really convenient because if I was out of town, I could. Mm-hmm. And it was a hot day, I could run the water hotter longer. You know, it makes sense for some of these features. The problem, of course, is that if you're buying a thermostat, and how many people actually need a thermostat that's interconnected? Well, you know, it's probably a smaller pool. It's not like everyone has to have one of these things, and therefore you're going to be trying to get your margins up and therefore you're going to spend less on the security protocols. And
well, businesses are different than homes. Mm-hmm. And I understand when people are a bit more lax with it. But with regard to a business, this is the type of thing where you say, I have my secure network and I have my insecure network.
Yeah, that's pretty easy.
And never the twain shall meet.
Yes.
And that was apparently not done because someone was able to get in through the thermometer. And... Which is
it's
a statement I would never have thought to say 20 years ago when we were starting to start.
You remember like the movie Hackers?
Yeah.
Or that era, right? The idea of that being the exploit, oh, they've got a thermometer in their house we can get into. You'd be like, no, you can't. That's stupid. Because that was before Wi-Fi, so.
Right.
This is why I don't use internet connected cameras. I just can't trust the.
Right. So you're going to be connecting through, in this case, a thermometer. You can connect up through many times like an air conditioning system, closed circuit TV, you know, those internet TV security TVs, major hackability, especially if you did not, if you paid for the cheaper ones.
I love that you buy a security system and you make yourself less secure. Like, oof, congratulations.
Yeah. So they basically jump from the thermometer to what the thermometer is connected to. To jump to another system, to end up getting to the database of high rollers in the casino.
Okay, so the casino didn't lose money. They just lost their information about their customers.
Yeah, although more and more the data is the money.
That's true. It also just seems like you don't normally hear, they made away with $20 million. You normally hear, and they made away with 20 million records and social security numbers. Right? Mm-hmm. Companies are obviously collecting a lot of that data and not protecting it, unlike financial records normally.
Right. And you think of, oh, if they got $20 million, that's different than if they got 20 million records. 20 million records seems so much more ephemeral, so much more abstract in our minds. But think if you had all of those and you got an average of $1 from each of those accounts. Of course, many of them you got a lot more and some of them you didn't get anything. That's $20 million. And that's not necessarily limited to one occasion.
Right.
Like, you can keep trying over and over again with a lot of them. Evolution is alive and well within the human species.
Well, that's good.
Because people talk about, like, how do we get to humans as though humans were the pinnacle. We're not. We are a transitional species just like every other. And one of those changes is that human beings are not all homogenous. I'm not talking about the superficial differences like skin color. Regionally, we have variation based upon skin color and other minor morphology. There are folks in, for example, descendants of the Inca in Peru that when they're climbing at high altitudes, they have an increased lung capacity. The same thing you see in Nepal and Tibet.
Yeah. Populations that lived in high altitudes.
Yes.
That population seemed to have better abilities to be in high altitudes.
Right. This one is one of the more extreme differences that I've seen, which is the Bajau, and I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly. They are
Bajau, B-A-J-A-U.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Who live in the general Pacific region.
It's a big area.
Yes.
Okay. The entire Pacific Rim.
No.
They travel a lot.
In the eastern portion of it. Well, okay. The side away from the U.S.
Okay. So we're talking about Asia and Southeast Asia.
Polynesian islands.
Yeah. Okay. All right, go on.
With most people, a lot of people have no skill in terms of holding their breath. You hold your breath and 15 seconds later, they're going, whew, that was a lot.
What's your longest holding breath?
When I was trying to do it.
And you were younger?
Yeah. I think around 2.5 minutes.
Oh, that's good. I did 2:10. 2.5, man. You always have to beat me on things. I'm all proud of my 2:10. Gosh. You know, the other day we visited your office down in Santa Cruz and we're leaving with your daughter and we took the stairs and you're like, yeah, wow, we're on stairs again. Could you used to beat me running up and downstairs?
No, I believe you were the one who brought up to my daughter. Do you know who won?
Well, I was bragging about her dad. I mean,
yeah.
You got to do that.
So I didn't pick that fight.
Yeah,
so.
But you still rubbed my... Your finger in my gut about it. Anyway, go on.
What a prodigious gut it is. So,
oh my God.
So this is normal. Like, and when you have people who are professional divers or people who are free divers, you know, competitions, you're going to get into like the 5 minute range.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yes,
this is training your body over long periods of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, here we have folks who are staying underwater for as long as 13 minutes.
The Bajau.
Mm-hmm. At depths of around 200 feet.
Wait, 13 minutes? How do you get rid of the carbon monoxide? How do you do this?
This is a mutation in DNA for larger spleens holding, you know, I believe it's repository for more red blood cells.
Wow.
So they're not half
sea lion.
But this is something that no matter how much training I go through. If my daughter were trained from now, when she's 6 years old, to go through her entire life to train, she would never be able to do 13 minutes underwater without severe brain damage and death. And I just thought it was such a cool story to bring up.
So that humans are diverse.
Yes.
It's pretty cool. Greg tells us the pronunciation is probably Bajau. In any case, awesome story. I heard recently something really interesting that the biodiversity in Homo sapiens in Africa is greater than anybody from outside of Africa to Africa.
Yes.
Bajau. I want to say it that way. Thanks, Miles. This was fun. Was there any...
Well, you put the accent on the end. Apparently, it was B with the schwa with the accent on the first.
No, it's...
So the accent is on the first syllable?
Here, you read it. It's on the Slack channel. We're using Slack. Go ahead and throw yourself on Slack. And I'll tell you that if you'd like to be a part of our Slack and chat with us off air and ask us questions and get invited to the show sometimes, you are welcome to do so. Just become a patron of ours. You can go to geekspeak.org/support, look at our patron page, submit a bit of money every month to us, and I will invite you into our GeekSpeak Slack channel and you can ask us and give us ideas for stories and all of that fun stuff like Greg and many people do. Can you pronounce that, Miles, now that you're reading it?
Bajau.
Miles, Elam, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak. And I know that you know, and I know that everyone that regularly listens knows, that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and uses permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use their stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know that we made it. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And today's title is by Greg Merkley in Canada, Augment Your Pictures at IKEA. Love the IKEA tone. And what about the goats? We didn't get the goats in there? Thank you so much for listening to us every week, and we will see you again soon. Miles Elam, thank you for joining me.
Always a pleasure.